Side 12. Domes of Fire. The Tomili, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 446. The cart was filled with lanterns, which the laborers were hanging from the battlements.
"No, no, no," Khalad chided them. "You can't put two green ones side by side like that. I've told you 1,000 times. White, green, red, blue. Do it the way I told you to do it. Be creative on your own time."
He sighed exaggeratedly.
"It's so hard to get good help these days, Your Highness," he said.
"You're overacting, Khalad," Sparhawk muttered.
"I know, but I want to be sure they're getting the point."
Kring came along the parapet, rubbing his hand over his scarred head.
"I need a shave," he said absently, "and Mirtai's too busy to attend to it."
"Is that a Paloi custom, Domi?" Sparhawk asked. "Is it one of the duties of a Paloi woman to shave her man's head?"
"No, actually it's Mirtai's personal idea. It's hard to see the back of your own head, and I used to miss a few places. Shortly after we were betrothed, she took my razor away from me and told me that from now on she was going to do the shaving. She does a very nice job, really, when she isn't too busy." He squared his shoulders. "They absolutely refused, Sparhawk," he reported. "I knew they would, but I put the matter before them the way you asked. They won't be locked up inside your fort during the battle. If you stop and think about it, though, we'll be much more useful ranging around the grounds on horseback anyway. A few score mounted Paloi will stir that mob around like a kettle full of boiling soup. If you want confusion out there tomorrow night, we'll give you lots of confusion. A man who's worried about getting a saber across the back of the head isn't going to be able to concentrate on attacking a fort."
"Particularly when his weapon doesn't work," Khalad added.
Sparhawk grunted. "Of course, we're assuming that the warehouse full of crossbows Kaalador found was the only one," he added.
"I'm afraid we won't find that out until tomorrow night," Khalad conceded. "I disabled about 600 of those things. If 1,200 crossbowmen come onto the palace grounds, we'll know that half of their weapons are going to work. We'll have to take cover at that point." "You there!" he shouted suddenly, looking upward. "Drape that bunting! Don't stretch it tight that way!"
He shook his fist at the workman leaning precariously out of a window high up in one of the towers. Although he was obviously quite young, the scholar Bevier escorted into Elana's presence was almost totally bald. He was very nervous, but his eyes had that burning glaze to them that announced him to be a fanatic. He prostrated himself before Elana's throne-like chair and banged his forehead on the floor.
"Don't do that, man," Uloth rumbled at him. "It offends the queen. Besides, you'll crack the floor tiles."
The scholar scrambled to his feet, his eyes fearful.
"This is Amuda," Bevier introduced him. "He's the scholar I told you about, the one with the interesting theory about Scarpa of Arjuna."
"Oh, yes," Elana said in Tamil. "Welcome, Master Amuda.
Sir Bevier has spoken highly of you."
Actually, Bevier had not, but a queen is allowed to take certain liberties with the truth. Amuda gave her a fawning sort of look. Sparhawk moved in quickly to cut off a lengthy, rambling preamble.
"Correct me if I'm wrong about this, Master Amuda," he said, "but our understanding of your theory is that you think that Scarpa's behind all these disturbances in Tomili."
"That's a slight oversimplification, sir,"
Amuda looked inquiringly at the tall Pandion knight.
"Sparhawk," Uloth supplied.
Amuda's face went white, and he began to tremble violently.
"I'm a simple sort of man, neighbor," Sparhawk told him. "Please don't confuse me with complications. What sort of evidence do you have that lays everything at Scarpa's door?"
"It's quite involved, Sir Sparhawk,"
Amuda apologized.
"Uninvolve it. Summarize, man, I'm busy."
Amuda swallowed very hard.
"Well, he faltered. "We know, that is, we're fairly certain, that Scarpa was the first of the spokesmen for these so-called heroes from the past."
Why do you say so-called, Master Amuda? Tinian asked him.
Sir Tinian still had his right arm in a sling.
Isn't it obvious, Sir Knight?
Amuda's tone was just slightly condescending.
The notion of resurrecting the dead is an absurdity. It's all quite obviously a hoax. Some henchman is dressed in ancient clothing, appears in a flash of light, which any country fair charlatan can contrive, and then starts babbling gibberish, which the spokesman identifies as an ancient language. Yes, it's clearly a hoax.
How clever of you to have unmasked it, Sophronia murmured. We all thought it was magic of some kind.
There's no such thing as magic, madam.
Really? She replied mildly. What an amazing thing.
I'd stake my reputation on that.
How courageous of you.
You say that Scarpa was the first of these revolutionaries to appear?
Vanyan asked him.
By more than a year, Sir Knight. The first reports of his activities began to appear in diplomatic dispatches from the capital at Arjuna just over 4 years ago. The next to emerge was Baron Perak of Daconia. And I have a sworn statement from a ship captain that Scarpa sailed from Kaftal in southwestern Arjuna to Ahar in Daconia. Ahar is Baron Perak's home, and he began his activities about 3 years ago. The connection is obvious.
It would seem so, wouldn't it? Sparhawk mused.
From Ahar, I have documented evidence of the travels of the two. Perak went into Eden, where he actually stayed in the hometown of Rebal. That connection gave me a bit of trouble, since Rebal isn't using his real name. He've identified his home district, though, and the town Perak visited is the district capital. I think I'm safe in assuming that a meeting took place during Perak's visit. While Perak was in Edom, Scarpa traveled all the way up into Astel. I can't exactly pinpoint his travels there, but I know he moved around quite a bit, just to the north of the marches on the Edomish-Astelian border, and that's the region where Saber makes his headquarters. The disturbances in Edom and Astel began some time after Scarpa and Perak had journeyed into those kingdoms. The evidence of connection among the four men is all very conclusive.
What about these reports of supernatural events? Tinian asked.
More hoaxes, Sir Knight.
Amuda's expression was offensively superior.
Pure charlatanism. You may have noticed that they always occur out in the countryside, where the only witnesses are superstitious peasants and ignorant serfs. Civilized people would not be fooled by such obvious trickery.
I wondered about that, Sparhawk said. Are you sure about this timetable of yours? Scarpa was the first to start stirring things up?
Definitely, Sir Sparhawk.
Then he contacted the others and enlisted them? Perhaps a year and a half later?
Amuda nodded.
Where did he go when he left Astel after recruiting Saber?
I've lost track of him for a time there, Sir Sparhawk.
He went into the Aline kingdoms of Western Tamale about 2.5 years ago and didn't return to Arjuna until 8 or 10 months later. I have no idea of where he was during that interim.
Oh, one other thing. The so-called vampires began to appear in Arjuna at almost precisely the same time that Scarpa began telling the Arjunai that he'd been in contact with Shaguan, their national hero.
The traditional monsters of the other kingdoms also put in their appearance at the same time these other revolutionaries began their campaigns.
Believe me, Your Majesty, he said earnestly to Aelana, if you're looking for a ringleader, Scarpa's your man.
We thank you for this information, Master Amuda, she said sweetly. Would you please provide Sir Bevier with your supporting data and describe your findings to him in greater detail? Pressing affairs necessarily limit the time we can spend with you, fascinating though we find your conclusions.
I shall be happy to share the entire body of my research with Sir Bevier, Your Majesty.
Bevier rolled his eyes ceilingward and sighed. They watched the enthusiast lead poor Bevier from the room.
I'd hate to have to take that case into any court, civil or ecclesiastical,
Emban snorted.
It is a bit thin, isn't it? Stragan agreed. The only thing that makes me pay any attention to him at all is that timetable of his, Sparhawk said.
Dolmont sent me to Lamorcand late last winter to look into the activities of Count Garrick. While I was there, I heard all the wild stories about Grichtnoff. It seems that our prehistoric Lamorc
started making appearances at a time that coincides almost exactly with the period when our scholarly friend lost track of Scarpa. Amuda's such a complete ass that I sort of hate to admit it, but he may just have hit upon the right answer.
But it's for all the wrong reasons, Sparhawk,
Amban objected. I'm only interested in his answers, Your Grace, Sparhawk replied. As long as they're the right answers, I don't care how he got them.
It's just too risky to do it any earlier, Sparhawk, Strachan said later that day.
You two are taking a lot of chances, Sparhawk objected. It's a whole lot more chancy to sort out earlier, Sparhawk, Kalidor drawled. If and we was to grab the leader sooner, them as is left could just call it all off, and all these traps ourn wouldn't catch no rabbits.
We gotta wait till they open that warehouse and start passing out them there weepins.
Sparhawk winced. Weepins? The word wouldn't appear in that particular dialect. Kalidor shrugged. I had to countrify it up, just for the sake of consistency. You switch back and forth like a frog on a hot rock, my friend.
I know. Infuriating, isn't it?
It goes like this, Sparhawk. If we pick up the conspirators any time before they start arming the mob, they'll be able to suspend operations and go to ground. They'll wait, reorganize, and then pick another day, which it is that we won't know nothing about. On the other hand, once they pass out the weapons, it'll be too late. There'll be thousands in the streets, most of them about half drunk. Our friends in the upper councils could no more stop them than stop the tide. The sheer momentum of this attempted coup will be working for us instead of for our shadowy friends.
They can still go to ground and just feed the mob to the wolves, you know.
Kalidor shook his head. Tamil justice is a bit abrupt, and an attack on the Emperor is going to be viewed as the worst sort of bad manners. Several hundred people are going to be sent to the headsman's block. Recruitment after that will be virtually impossible. They have no choice. Once they start, they have to follow through.
You're talking about some very delicate timing, you know.
Oh, that's easy, tuck care of, Sparhawk,
Kalidor grinned.
There's this here temple right smack dab in the middle of town. It's more than likely all full of cobwebs and dust on account of our little yaller brothers don't take their religion none too serious like. There's these here priests as sits around in there, drinking and carousing and sich. When they gets theirselves all beered up and boisterous like, they usual decides to hold services. They got this here bell, which it is as must weigh along about 20 ton or so. One of them there drunk priests, he wobbles over to that there bell, and he takes up this here sledgehammer, and he whacks the bell a couple licks with it. Makes the awfulest sound you ever did hear. Sailors been known to hear it about 10 leagues out to sea. Now, there ain't no special time set for when they goes to whacking on that there bell. Folks here in Mathurian don't pay no attention to it, figuring that it's just the priests enjoying theirselves.
That's the beauty of it, Sparhawk, he said, lapsing into normal speech. The sound of that bell is random, and nobody takes any special note of it. Tomorrow night, though, it's going to be profoundly significant. As soon as that warehouse opens, the bell's going to peal out its message of hope and joy. The murderers, sitting almost in the laps of the people we want to talk with, will take that as their order to move. We'll have the whole lot rounded up in under a minute.
What if they try to resist?
Well, there'll be some losses, Kalidor shrugged. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. There are several dozen people we want to pick up, so we can afford to lose a few.
The sound of the bell will also alert you, Sparhawk, Strachan pointed out. When you hear it start ringing, you'll know that it's time to move your wife's party inside.
But you can't do this, Your Majesty, the Minister of the Interior protested shrilly the next morning, as tons of water began to gush into the moat from the throats of the huge pipes strewn across the lawn of the Imperial compound.
Oh?
Elana asked innocently.
And why is that, Minister Colata?
There's no sub-foundation under the moat, Your Majesty. The water will just sink into the ground.
Oh, that's all right, Minister Colata. It's only for one night. I'm sure the moat will stay full enough until after the party.
Colata stared with chagrin at a sudden fountain-like eruption of air and muddy water out in the center of the moat.
"My goodness,"
Elana said mildly, looking at the sudden whirlpool funneling down where the eruption had taken place.
"There must have been an old abandoned cellar under there."
She laughed a silvery little laugh.
"I'd imagine that the rats who lived in there were very surprised. Wouldn't you agree, Your Excellency?"
Colata looked a bit sick. Would you excuse me, Your Majesty?" he said, and he turned to hurry across the lawn without waiting for a reply.
"Don't let him get away, Sparhawk," Elana said coolly. "I strongly suspect that Lord Vanyan's list wasn't as complete as we might have hoped. Why don't you invite the Minister of the Interior into the castle, so that you can show him our other preparations?"
She tapped one finger thoughtfully against her chin.
"And you might ask Sir Calton and Sir Olaf to join you when you get around to showing His Excellency the torture chamber. Emperor Sarabian's excellent Minister of the Interior might want to add a few names to Vanyan's list."
It was the cool and unruffled way she said it that chilled Sparhawk's blood the most.
"He's beginning to feel more than a little offended, Sparhawk,"
Vanyan said soberly, as the two of them watched Khalad's workmen decorating the vast gates of the imperial compound.
"He's not stupid, and he knows that we're not telling him everything."
"It can't be helped, Vanyan. He's just too erratic to be let in on all the details."
"Mercurial might be a more diplomatic term."
"Whatever. We don't really know him all that well, Vanyan, and we're operating in an alien society. For all we know, he keeps a diary and writes everything down. That could be a Tamil custom. It's entirely possible that our whole plan could be available to the chambermaid who makes up his bed every morning."
"You're speculating, Sparhawk."
"These ambushes out in the countryside weren't speculation."
"Surely you don't suspect the Emperor?"
"Somebody passed the word of our expeditions along to our enemy, Vanyan. We can apologize to the Emperor after this evening's entertainment is concluded."
"Oh, that's just too obvious, Sparhawk,"
Vanyan burst out, pointing at the heavy steel lattice Khalad's workmen were installing on the inside of the gates. "It won't be visible when they open the gates all the way, Vanyan, and Khalad's going to hang bunting on the lattice to conceal it. Did Sophronia have any luck when she tried to contact Zelasta?"
"No. He must still be too far away."
"I'd be a lot more comfortable if he were here. If the troll gods put in an appearance tonight, we could be in very serious trouble."
"Afriel can deal with them."
"Not without revealing her true identity, she can't. And if that comes out, my wife's going to find out some things I'd rather she didn't know. I'm not so fond of Sarabian that I'm willing to risk Elana's sanity just to keep him on his throne." The sun crept slowly down the western sky, moving closer and closer to the horizon. Although he knew it to be an absurdity, it seemed to Sparhawk that the blazing orb was plummeting to earth like a shooting star. There were so many details, so many things that had yet to be done. Worse yet, many of those tasks could not even be commenced until after the sun went down, and gathering darkness concealed them from the hundreds of eyes that were certainly out there watching. It was early evening when Calton finally came to the royal apartment to announce that they had gone as far as they could go until after dark. Sparhawk was relieved to know that at least that much had been completed on time. "Was the Minister of the Interior at all forthcoming?" Elana asked from her chair near the window, where Aileen and Melodir were involved in the extended process known as doing her hair.
"Oh, yes, Your Majesty," Calton replied with a broad grin. "He seems even more eager to talk than your cousin Lycius was. Olaf can be very persuasive at times. Colata seemed to be particularly upset by the leeches."
"Leeches?"
Calton nodded.
"It was right after Olaf offered to stuff him head down into a barrel full of leeches that Colata developed this burning desire to share things with us."
"Dear God!"
The queen shuddered. It was the general opinion of all the guests present that evening that the Queen of Alenia's party was absolutely the crowning event of the season. The lanterns illuminating the mother-of-pearl battlements were spectacular. The gay buntings, several thousand yards of very expensive silk, were festive,
and the orchestra on the battlements playing traditional Aline airs rather than the discordant cacophony that passed for music in Sarabian's court, lent a pleasantly archaic quality to the entire occasion. It was the barges moored in the moat, however, that drew the most astonished comment. The idea of dining out of doors had never occurred to the Tamils, and the notion of floating dining rooms ablaze with candlelight and draped with brightly colored silk bunting was quite beyond the imagination of the average member of the emperor's court. The candles caused the knights no end of concern. The thought of open flame so close to the hidden cargo of the barges was sufficient to make strong men turn pale. Since the party was taking place around the Aline castle, and the hostess was herself an Aline, the ladies of the emperor's court had quite nearly exhausted the creative talents of every dressmaker in Mathirion in their efforts to dress Aline. The results were not uniformly felicitous, however, since the dressmakers of Mathirion were obliged to rely on books for inspiration, and many of the books in the library of the university were several hundred years old, and the gowns depicted on their pages were terribly out of fashion. Aelana and Melodir were in fashion, however, and they were the absolute center of attention. Aelana's gown was a regal blue, and she wore a diamond and ruby-studded tiara nestled in her pale blonde hair. Melodir was gowned in lavender. It seemed to be her favorite color. Mirtai was defiantly not in fashion. She wore the blue sleeveless gown she had worn at her owner's wedding, and this time she was visibly armed. Rather surprisingly, Sifrinia also wore an Aline gown, of snowy white, naturally, and Vanyan was obviously smitten by her all over again. The knights of the queen's escort wore doublets and hose, much against Sparhawk's better judgment. Their armor, however, was close at hand. After the members of the imperial court had made their appearance and had begun to circulate on the barges, there was a pause, and then a brazen Aline fanfare.
"I had to offer violence to the musicians to get them to greet the emperor properly," the elegantly garbed Stragan muttered to Sparhawk.
"Oh?"
"They were very insistent that the emperor should be greeted by that dreadful noise they call music around here. They became much more cooperative after I sliced the smock off one of the trumpeters with my rapier."
Stragan's eyes suddenly widened.
"For God's sake, man," he hissed at a servant placing a large platter of steaming beef on one of the tables. "Be careful of those candles."
"He's a Tamil, Stragan," Sparhawk pointed out when the servant gave the Thalesian a blank stare. "You're trying to talk to him in Alenic."
"Make him be careful, Sparhawk. A single tongue of fire in the wrong place on any of these barges could broil us all alive."
Then the emperor and his nine wives appeared on the drawbridge and came down the carpeted steps to the first barge. Everyone bowed to the emperor, but no one looked at him. All eyes were locked on the radiantly smiling Empress Elisun of Valesia. She had modified the customary Aline costume to accommodate her cultural tastes. Her scarlet gown was really quite lovely, but it had been altered so that those attributes Aline ladies customarily concealed, and Valesian ladies flaunted, were nestled on two frilly cushions of snowy lace, and were thus entirely, even aggressively, in full view.
"Now that is what you might call a fashion statement," Stragan murmured.
"That it is, my friend," Sparhawk chuckled, adjusting the collar of his black velvet doublet. "And everybody's listening to her. Poor M'Ban appears to be quite nearly on the verge of apoplexy."
In a kind of formal little ceremony, Queen Aelana escorted Sarabian and his empresses across the bridges that stepped from barge to barge. The Empress Elisun was obviously looking for someone, and when she saw Barrett standing off to one side on the second barge, she altered course and bore down upon him with all sails set, figuratively speaking, of course. Sir Barrett looked at first apprehensive, then desperate, as Elisun more or less pinned him to the rail of the barge, without so much as laying a hand on him.
"Poor Barrett," Sparhawk said sympathetically. "Stay close to him, Stragan. I don't know for sure if he can swim. Be ready to rescue him if he jumps into the moat."
After the Emperor had been given the grand tour, the banquet began. Sparhawk had judiciously spaced the knights among the diners. The knights were not really very interesting dinner companions, since they all concentrated almost exclusively on the candles and the lanterns. "God help us if a wind comes up," Carlton muttered to Sparhawk.
"Truly," Sparhawk agreed fervently.
"Ah, Carlton, old friend."
"Yes?"
"You're supposed to be keeping an eye on the candles, not the front of the Empress Elisun's gown."
"What front?"
"Don't be vulgar, and remember what you're supposed to be doing here."
"How are we going to herd this flock of overdressed sheep inside when that bell rings?"
Carlton shifted uncomfortably. His green satin doublet was buttoned very tightly across his stomach. "If we've timed it right, the feasters will be finishing up the main course at just about the same time as our friends out in the city start distributing the weapons. When that bell rings, Aelan is going to invite all the revelers into the castle for the dessert course."
"Very clever, Sparhawk," Carlton said admiringly.
"Go congratulate my wife, Carlton. It was her idea."
"She's really awfully good at this sort of thing, you know that? I'm glad she decided to come along."
"I'm still of two minds about that," Sparhawk grunted. The feast went on, and there were toasts by the dozen. The feasters heaped praise upon the Queen of Alenia, since the revelers were totally unaware of the impending climax of the evening. There were many inadvertent ironies in the compliments. Sparhawk scarcely tasted his dinner as he picked at his food, his eyes constantly on the candles, and his ears alert for the first sound of the bell that would announce that his enemies were on the move. Carlton's appetite, however, seemed unaffected by the impending crisis.
"How can you stuff yourself that way?" Sparhawk asked his friend irritably.
"Just keeping up my strength, Sparhawk. I'm likely to burn up a lot of energy before the night's out. If you're not busy, old boy, would you mind passing that gravy down this way?"
Then, from somewhere near the center of the gleaming, moon-drenched city of Matherion, a deep-toned bell began to boom, announcing that the second half of the evening's entertainment had begun.
Chapter 29. "Why didn't you tell me, Aelana?" Sarabian demanded. The Emperor's face was livid with suppressed fury, and his heavy gold crown was slightly askew.
"Please calm yourself, Sarabian," the blonde queen suggested. "We didn't find out until mid-morning today, and there was no possible way to get the information to you without taking the chance of compromising it."
"Your snake-hipped baroness could have carried a message to me," he accused, smacking his palm down on the battlement. They were on the parapet, ostensibly admiring the view.
"My fault there, Your Majesty," Sparhawk apologized. "I'm more or less in charge of security, and Minister Colata's the man who controls the police in Tamale, both the overt police and the ones who hide in the bushes. There was no way we could be absolutely sure that our subterfuge involving the Baroness had been successful. The information that we had discovered the Minister's involvement was just too sensitive to risk. This attempt on your government tonight has to go off as planned. If our enemy gets the slightest hint that we know what he's up to, he'll postpone things until another day, and we won't have any idea of which day it's going to be."
"I'm still very put out with you, Sparhawk," Sarabian complained. "I can't fault your reasoning, but you've definitely bruised my feelings."
"We're supposed to be watching the play of lights on the waters of the moat, Sarabian," Aelana reminded the Emperor. "Please at least glance over the battlements once in a while."
Their position on the parapet gave them privacy and a good vantage point from which to watch for the approach of the mob.
"The news about Colata's involvement in this business is really distressing," Sarabian fretted. "He controls the police, palace security, and all the spies inside the Empire. Worse than that, he has a certain amount of authority over the Aetons. If we lose them, we're in very serious trouble."
"And Gessa's trying to sever that connection, Your Majesty," Sparhawk told him. "He sent runners to the Aeton forces outside the city to advise the commanders that the agents of the Ministry of the Interior aren't to be trusted. The commanders will pass that on to Andral and Betwana."
"Are we safe here in the event that Aeton and Gessa's runners are intercepted?" "Sir Bevier assures us that he can hold this castle for 5 years, Sarabian," Aelana told him. "And Bevier's the expert on sieges."
"And when the 5 years runs out?"
The church knights will be here long before then, Your Majesty, Sparhawk assured him. Kaalador has his instructions. If things go awry, he'll get word to Dolmont and Kyrellos.
You people are still making me very, very nervous.
Trust me, Your Majesty, Sparhawk said.
Calton came puffing up the stairs to the parapet.
We're going to need more wine, Sparhawk, he said. I think we made a mistake when we set those wine casks in the courtyard. The Queen's guests are lingering down there, and they're swilling down Archean red like water.
May I draw on your wine cellar, Sarabian? Elana asked sweetly.
Sarabian winced.
Why are you pouring all that drink into them? He demanded. Archean red's very expensive here in Matherion.
Drunk people are easier to manage than sober ones, Your Majesty, Calton shrugged. We'll let them continue to carouse down there in the courtyard and inside the castle until the fighting starts. Then we'll push the stragglers inside the castle with the others and keep them drinking. When they wake up tomorrow morning, most of them won't even know there's been a battle.
The party in the courtyard was growing noisier. Tommel wines were not nearly as robust as Aline vintages, and the wits of the revelers had become fuddled. They laughed a great deal, and walked about the yard unsteadily with silly grins on their faces. Queen Elana looked critically down from the parapet. How much longer would you say it's going to take them to be totally incapacitated, Sparhawk? She asked.
Not much longer. He shrugged.
He turned and looked out toward the city.
I don't want to seem critical, Emperor Sarabian, but I have to point out that your citizenry is profoundly unimaginative. Your rebels out there are carrying torches.
So?
It's a cliché, Your Majesty. The mob in every bad Archean romance ever written carries torches. Even I know that.
How can you be so cool, man? Sarabian demanded. If someone made a loud noise behind me right now, I'd jump out of my skin.
Professional training, I guess. I'm more concerned that they might not reach the Imperial compound than that they will. We want them to come here, Your Majesty.
Shouldn't you raise the drawbridge?
Not yet. There are conspirators here in the compound, as well as out there in the streets. We don't want to give away the fact that we know they're coming.
Khalad thrust his head out of the turret at the corner of the battlements and beckoned to his lord.
Will you excuse me, Your Majesties? Sparhawk asked politely. I have to go put on my work clothes. Oh, Elana, why don't you signal Calton that it's time to push those stragglers inside and lock them in the dining hall with the others?
What's this? Sarabian asked. We don't want them underfoot when the fighting starts, Sarabian. The queen smiled. The wine should keep them from noticing that they're locked in the dining room. You Alines are the most cold-blooded people in the world, Sarabian accused, as Sparhawk moved off down the parapet, toward the turret where Khalad was waiting with a suit of black armor. When he returned about 10 minutes later, he was dressed in steel. He found Elana talking earnestly with Sarabian.
Can't you talk with her? She was saying. The poor young man's on the verge of hysteria.
Why doesn't he just do what she wants him to? Once they've entertained each other, she'll lose interest.
Sir Barrett's a very young knight, Sarabian. His ideals haven't been tarnished yet. Why doesn't she chase after Sir Calton or Sir Ulaf? They'd be happy to oblige her. Sir Barrett's a challenge to Elisoon, Elana. Nobody's ever turned her down before. Doesn't her rampant infidelity bother you?
Not in the slightest. It doesn't really mean anything in her culture, you see. Her people look upon it as a pleasant but unimportant pastime. I sometimes think you Alines place far too much significance on it.
Can't you make her put some clothes on?
Why? She's not ashamed of her body, and she enjoys sharing it with people. Be honest, Elana. Don't you find her quite attractive?
I think you'd have to ask my husband about that.
You don't really expect me to answer that kind of question, do you? Sparhawk said.
He looked over the battlements.
Our friends out there seem to have found their way to the palace compound, he noted, as the torch-bearing rioters began to stream through the gate onto the grounds.
The guards are supposed to stop them, Sarabian said angrily.
The guards are taking their orders from Minister Colata, I expect.
Elana shrugged. Where's the Aton garrison, then?
We've moved them inside the castle here, Your Majesty, Sparhawk advised him. I think you keep overlooking the fact that we want those people on the grounds. It wouldn't make much sense to impede their progress.
Isn't it about time to raise the drawbridge? Sarabian seemed nervous about that.
Not yet, Your Majesty,
Sparhawk replied coolly. We want them all to be inside the compound first. At that point, Kring will close the gates. Then we'll raise the drawbridge. Let them take the bait before we spring the trap on them.
You sound awfully sure of yourself, Sparhawk.
We have all the advantages, Your Majesty.
Does that mean that nothing can possibly go wrong?
No, something can always go wrong, but the probabilities are remote.
You don't mind if I worry a little bit anyway, do you?
Go right ahead, Your Majesty.
The mob from the streets of Matherion continued to stream unimpeded through the main gate of the Imperial grounds and fanned out rapidly, shouting excitedly as they crashed their way into the various palaces and administration buildings. As Kring had anticipated, many emerged from the gleaming buildings burdened down with assorted valuables they had looted from the interiors. There was a brief flurry of activity in front of the castle when one group of looters reached the drawbridge and encountered a score of mounted knights under the command of Sir Ulaf. The knights were there to provide cover for the Poloi, who had been hidden in the holds of the barges during the earlier festivities, and who had fallen to work on the naphtha casks with their axes as soon as the revelers had retired to the castle yard. A certain amount of glistening seepage from the sides of the barges indicated that the axemen crossing the decks of the festive vessels in the moat toward the drawbridge had done their work well. When the mob reached the outer end of the drawbridge, Ulaf made it abundantly clear to them that he was in no mood to receive callers. The survivors decided to find other places to loot. The courtyard had been cleared, and Bevier and his men were moving their catapults into place on the parapet, and Gessa's Atons had moved up onto the parapets with the Serenix and were crouched down out of sight behind the battlements. Sparhawk looked around. Everything seemed in readiness. Then he looked at the gates of the compound. The only revolutionaries coming in now were the lame and the halt. They crutched their way along vigorously, but they had lagged far behind their companions. Sparhawk leaned out over the battlements.
We might as well get started, Ulaf, he called down to his friend. Why don't you ask Kring to close the gates? Then you should probably come inside. Right.
Ulaf's face was split with a broad grin. He lifted his curled ogre horn to his lips and blew a hollow-sounding blast. Then he turned and led his knights back across the drawbridge into the castle. The huge gate at the entrance to the palace grounds moved ponderously, slowly, swinging shut with a dreadful kind of inexorability. Sparhawk noted that several of those still outside stumped along desperately on their crutches, trying for all they were worth to get inside before the gate closed.
Calton! He yelled down to the courtyard. What?
Calton's tone was irritable.
Would you like to let those people out there know that we're not receiving any more visitors tonight? Oh, all right. I suppose so.
Then the blonde Pandion grinned up at his fellow knight as he and his men began turning the capstan that raised the drawbridge.
Clown, Sparhawk muttered.
The significance of the simultaneous closing of the gate and raising of the drawbridge did not filter through the collective mind of the mob for quite some time. Then sounds of shouted commands and even occasional clashes of weapons from nearby buildings announced that at least some of the rebels were beginning, however faintly, to see the light. Tentatively, warily, the torch-bearing mob began to converge on the pristinely white Aline castle, where the gaily colored silk buntings shivered tremulously in the night breeze, and the lantern and candlelit barges bobbed sedately in the moat.
"Hello, the castle!"
a bull-voiced fellow in the front rank roared in execrable Alenic.
"Lower your drawbridge, or we'll storm your walls!"
Would you please reply to that, Bevier?
Sparhawk called to his Serenic friend. Bevier grinned and carefully shifted one of his catapults. He sighted carefully, elevated his line of sight so that the catapult was pointed almost straight up, and then he applied the torch to the mixture of pitch and naphtha in the spoon-like receptacle at the end of the catapult arm. The mixture took fire immediately.
I command you to lower your drawbridge.
The unshaven knave out beyond the moat bellowed arrogantly. Bevier cut the retaining rope on the catapult arm. The blob of dripping fire sizzled as it shot almost
straight up into the air. Then it slowed and seemed to hang motionless for a moment. Then it fell. The ruffian who had been demanding admittance gaped at Bevier's reply as it majestically rose into the night sky and then fell directly upon him like a comet. He vanished as he was engulfed in fire.
"Good shot,"
Sparhawk called his compliment. "Not bad," Bevier replied modestly. "It was sort of tricky because he was so close."
"I noticed that."
Emperor Sarabian had gone very pale, and he was visibly shaken. "Did you have to do that, Sparhawk?" he demanded in a choked voice, as the now frightened mob fled back across the lawns to positions that may or may not have been out of Sir Bevier's range.
"Yes, Your Majesty," Sparhawk replied calmly. "We're playing for time here.
The bell that started to ring an hour or so ago was a sort of general signal. Ka'alador's cutthroats took the ringleaders into custody when it rang. Aelana moved the partygoers inside the castle, and the Aeton legions outside the city started to march as soon as they heard it. That loudmouth, who's presently on fire at the edge of the moat, is graphic demonstration of just how truly unpleasant things are going to get if the mob decides to insist on being admitted. It's going to take some serious encouragement to persuade them to approach us again."
"I thought you said you could hold them off."
"We can, but why risk lives if you don't have to? You'll note that there was no cheering or shouts when Bevier shot his catapult. Those people out there are staring at an absolutely silent, apparently unmanned castle that almost negligently obliterates offensive people. That's a terrifying sort of thing to contemplate. This is the part of the siege that frequently lasts for several years."
Sparhawk looked down the parapet.
"I think it's time for us to move inside that turret, Your Majesties," he suggested. "We can't be positive that Khalad disabled all the crossbows, or that somebody in the mob hasn't repaired a few. I'd have a great deal of trouble explaining why I was careless enough to let one of you get killed. We can see what's going on from the turret, and I'll feel much better if you've both got nice thick stone walls around you."
"Shouldn't we rupture those barges now, dear?"
Aelana asked him.
"Not just yet. We've got the potential for inflicting a real disaster on the besiegers there. Let's not waste it."
Some few of the crossbows in the hands of the mob functioned properly, but not very many. There seemed to be a great deal of swearing about that. A serious attempt to reopen the gates of the compound fell apart when the Paloi, their sabers flashing and their shrill, ululating war cries echoing back from the walls of nearby opalescent palaces, charged across the neatly clipped lawns to savage the crowd clustered around the gate. Then, because once the Paloi had been unleashed, they were very hard to rein in again, the tribesmen from the marches of eastern Pelosia sliced back and forth through the huddled mass cowering on the grass. The palace guards who had joined the mob made some slight effort to respond, but the Paloi horsemen gleefully rode them down. Sephrenia and Vanyan entered the turret. The small Styric woman's white gown gleamed in the shaft of moonlight streaming in through the door.
"What are you thinking of, Sparhawk?" she demanded angrily. "This isn't a safe place for Aelana and Sarabian."
"I think it's as safe as I can manage, little mother. Aelana, what would you say if I told you that you had to go inside?"
"I'd say no, Sparhawk. I'd crawl out of my skin if you locked me up in some safe room where I couldn't see what's going on."
"I sort of thought you might feel that way. And you, Emperor Sarabian?"
"Your wife just nailed my feet to the floor, Sparhawk. How could I possibly run off and hide while she's standing up here on the wall like the figurehead on a warship?" The Emperor looked at Sephrenia.
"Is this insane foolhardiness a racial characteristic of these barbarians?" he asked her.
She sighed.
"You wouldn't believe some of the things they're capable of, Sarabian," she replied, throwing a quick smile at Vanyan.
"At least someone in that mob's still thinking coherently, Sparhawk," Vanyan said to his friend. "He's just realized that there are all sorts of unpleasant implications in the fact that they can't get in here or out of the compound. He's out there trying to whip them up by telling them that they're doomed unless they take this castle." "I hope he's also telling them that they're doomed if they try," Sparhawk replied. "I'd imagine that he's glossing over that part. I had some misgivings about you when you were a novice, my friend. You and Colton seemed like a couple of wild colts. But now that you've settled down, you're really quite good. Your strategy here has been brilliant, you know. You actually haven't embarrassed me too much this time.
Thanks, Vanyan, Sparhawk said dryly.
No charge.
The rebels approached the moat tentatively, their faces filled with apprehension, and their eyes fixed on the night sky, desperately searching for that first flicker of fire that would announce that Sir Bevier was sending them greetings. The chance passage of a shooting star across the velvet throat of night elicited screams of fright, followed by a vast, nervous laugh. The gleaming, brightly lighted castle, however, remained silent. No soldiers lined the battlements. No globs of liquid fire sprang into the night sky from within those nacreous walls. The defenders crouched silently behind the battlements and waited.
Good, Vanyan muttered after a quick glance out of one of the embrasures in the turret. Someone saw the potential of those barges. They've clapped together some scaling ladders.
We have to rupture those barges now, Vanyan, Ilana exclaimed urgently.
You didn't tell her? Vanyan asked. Sparhawk.
No, the concept might have been difficult for her to accept.
You'd better take her back inside the castle, then, my friend. What's going to happen next is likely to upset her a great deal.
Will you two stop talking about me as if I weren't even here? Ilana burst out in exasperation. What are you going to do?
You'd better tell her, Vanyan said bleakly.
We can start that fire at any time, Ilana. Sparhawk said as gently as he could. In a situation like this, fire's a weapon. It's not tactically practical to waste it by setting it off before your enemies are around to receive its benefits. She stared at him, the blood draining from her face. This wasn't what I'd planned, Sparhawk, she said vehemently. The fire's supposed to keep them away from the moat. I didn't want you to burn them alive with it. I'm sorry, Ilana. It's a military decision. A weapon's useless unless you demonstrate your willingness to employ it. I know it's hard to accept, but if we take your plan to its ultimate application, it may save lives in the long run. We're outnumbered here in Tomoli, and if we don't establish a certain reputation for ruthlessness, we'll be overrun the next time there's a confrontation. You're a monster. No, dear. I'm a soldier. She suddenly started to cry. Would you take her inside now, little mother? Sparhawk asked. Sophronia. I think we'd all rather she didn't see this. Sophronia nodded and took the weeping queen to the stairway leading down from the turret.
You might want to go too, Your Majesty, Vanyan suggested to Sarabian. Sparhawk and I are more or less accustomed to this sort of unpleasantness. You don't have to watch, though.
No, I'll stay, Lord Vanyan, Sarabian said firmly.
That's up to you, Your Majesty.
A sheet of crossbow bolts rattled against the battlements like hail. It appeared that the rebels had been repairing the results of Khalad's tampering. Then, fearfully, splashing in panicky desperation, swimmers leapt from the edge of the moat and struggled their way to the barges to slip the mooring lines. The barges were quickly pulled to shore, and the rebels, their makeshift scaling ladders already raised, swarmed on board and began to pull their way rapidly across the moat to the sheer castle wall. Sparhawk stuck his head out through the doorway of the turret.
Colton,
he whispered to his friend, who was crouched down on the parapet not far from the turret.
Pass the word. Tell the Aetons to get ready.
Right.
But tell them not to move until they hear the signal.
I know what I'm doing, Sparhawk. Quit treating me like an idiot.
Sorry.
The urgent whisper sped around the battlements.
Your timing's perfect, Sparhawk, Vanyan said tensely in a low voice. I just saw Kring's signal from the compound wall. The Aetons are outside the gate.
He paused.
You're having an unbelievable run of good luck, you know. Nobody could have guessed in advance that the mob would start up the wall and the Aetons would arrive at precisely the same time.
Probably not. Sparhawk agreed. I think we might want to do something nice for Afriel the next time we see her. In the moat below, the barges bumped against the castle walls, and the rebels began their desperate scramble up the ladders toward the ominously silent battlements.
Another urgent whisper slithered back around the parapet.
"The barges are all up against the wall now, Sparhawk,"
Carlton whispered hoarsely.
"All right." Sparhawk drew in a deep breath. "Tell Ulof to give the signal."
"Ulof!"
Carlton shouted, no longer even bothering to whisper.
"Toot your horn! Toot!"
Ulof's voice was outraged. Then his ogre horn rang out its message of pain and death. From around the parapet, great boulders were lifted, teetered a moment on the battlements, and then plummeted down onto the swarming decks of the barges below. The barges ruptured, splintered, and began to sink. The viscous mixture of naphtha and pitch spread out across the surface of the moat. The spreading slick was rainbow-hued, and, Sparhawk absently thought, really rather pretty. The towering Aetons rose from their places of concealment, took up the lanterns conveniently hanging from the battlements, and hurled them down into the moat like 100 flaring comets. The rebels who had leapt from the sinking barges, and who were struggling in the oily water below, screamed in terror as they saw flaming death raining down on them from above. The moat exploded. A sheet of blue fire shot across the naphtha-stained water, and it was immediately followed by towering billows of sooty orange flame and dense black smoke. There were volcano-like eruptions from the sinking barges as the deadly, unspilled naphtha still in their holds took fire. The flames belched upward to sear the rebels still clinging to the scaling ladders. They fell or jumped from the burning ladders, streaking flame as they plunged into the inferno below. The screams were dreadful. Some few of the burning men reached the far bank of the moat and ran blindly across the tidy lawns of the compound, shrieking and dripping fire. The rebels who had stood at the brink of the moat, impatiently awaiting their turn to cross the intervening water to scale the walls, recoiled in horror from the sudden conflagration that had just made the gleaming castle of the Alenes as unreachable as the far side of the moon.
"Ulof!"
Sparhawk roared.
"Tell Kring to open the gate!"
Once more the ogre horn sang. The massive gates of the compound swung slowly open, and the golden Aeton giants, running in perfect unison, swept into the imperial compound like an avalanche. Chapter 30. "I don't know how they did it, Sparhawk," Kalidor replied with a dark scowl. "Krager himself hasn't been seen for days. He's a slippery one, isn't he?" Kalidor had located Sparhawk on the parapet.
"That he is, my friend. What about the others? I wouldn't have thought that Elrond could have managed something like that."
"Neither would I. He was doing everything but wearing a sign reading conspirator on his forehead. All the swirling of his cape and exaggerated tiptoeing through back alleys." Kalidor shook his head. "Anyway, he was staying in the house of a local Edomish nobleman. We know he was inside, because we watched him go in through the front door. We were watching every single door and window, so we know he didn't come back out. But he wasn't inside when we went to pick him up." There was a crash from a nearby palace, as the Aetons broke in the doors to get at the rebels hiding inside.
"Did your people check the house for hidden rooms or passages?" Sparhawk asked.
Kalidor shook his head. "They stood the Edomish noble barefoot in a brazier of hot coals instead. It's faster that way. There was no place to hide in that house." "I'm sorry, Sparhawk. We picked up all the second raiders without a hitch. But the leaders..." He spread his hands helplessly.
"Somebody was probably using magic. They've done it before."
"Can you really do that sort of thing with magic?"
"I can't, but I'm sure Sephrenia knows the proper spells."
Kalidor looked out over the battlements.
"Well, at least we broke up this attack on the government. That's the main thing." "I'm not so sure," Sparhawk disagreed.
"It was fairly important, Sparhawk. If they'd succeeded, all of Tomali would have flown apart. As soon as the Aetons finish mopping up, we'll be able to start questioning survivors. And those underlings we did manage to catch. They might be able to direct us to the important plotters."
"I sort of doubt it. Krager's very good at this sort of thing. I think we'll find that the underlings don't actually have a lot of information."
"It's a shame.
I really wanted to have a little talk with Krager.
You always get that tone of voice when you talk about him,
Kalidor observed. Is there something personal between you two?
Oh, yes. And it goes back a long, long way. I've missed any number of opportunities to kill him, usually because it wasn't convenient. I was too busy concentrating on the man who employed him, and that may have been a mistake. Krager always makes sure that he's got just enough information to make him too valuable to kill. The next time I come across him, I think I'll just ignore that.
The Etons were efficiency personified as they rounded up the rebels. They offered the armed insurgents one opportunity to surrender each time they surrounded a group, and they didn't ask twice. By 2 hours past midnight, the Imperial compound was quiet again. A few Etan patrols searched the grounds and buildings for any rebels who might have gone into hiding, but there was little in the way of significant activity. Sparhawk was bone-tired. Though he had not physically participated in the suppression of the rebellion, the tension had exhausted him more than a 2-hour battle might have. He stood on the parapet looking wearily down into the compound, watching without much interest as the groundskeepers, who had been pressed into service for the unpleasant task, cringingly pulled the floating dead out of the moat.
"Why don't you go to bed, Sparhawk?"
It was Halad. His bare, heavy shoulders gleamed in the torchlight. His voice and appearance and brusque manner were so much like his father's that Sparhawk once again felt that brief, renewed pang of sorrow.
"I just want to be sure that there won't be any bodies left floating in the moat when my wife wakes up tomorrow morning. People who've been burned to death aren't very pretty."
"I'll take care of that. Let's go to the bathhouse. I'll help you out of your armor, and you can soak in a tub of hot water for a while."
"I didn't really exert myself very much this evening, Halad. I didn't even work up a sweat."
"You don't have to. That smell's so ingrained into your armor that 5 minutes after you put it on, you smell as if you haven't bathed for a month."
"It's one of the drawbacks of the profession. Are you sure you want to be a knight?"
"It wasn't my idea in the first place."
"Maybe when this is all over, the world will settle down enough so that there won't be any need for armored knights anymore."
"Of course. And maybe someday fish will fly, too."
"You're a cynic, Halad."
"What is he doing up there?"
Halad demanded irritably, looking up toward the towers soaring over the castle.
"Who's doing what where?"
"There's somebody up in the very top of that south tower. This is the fourth time I've caught a flicker of candlelight through that window."
"Maybe Tinian or Bevier put one of their knights up there to keep watch."
Sparhawk shrugged.
"Without telling you? Or Lord Vanyan?"
"If it worries you so much, let's go take a look."
"You don't sound very concerned."
"I'm not. This castle's absolutely secure, Halad."
"I'll go have a look after I get you ready for bed."
"No, I'll go along."
"I thought you were certain that the castle's secure."
"It never hurts to be careful. I don't want to have to tell your mothers that I made a mistake and got you killed."
They went down from the battlements, crossed the courtyard, and went into the main building. There were loud snores coming from behind the bolted door of the main dining hall.
"I'd imagine that there are going to be some monumental headaches emerging from that room in the morning,"
Halad laughed.
"We didn't force our guests to drink so much."
"They'll accuse us of it, though."
They started up the stairway that led to the top of the south tower. Although the main tower and the north tower had been constructed in the usual fashion, with rooms stacked atop each other, the south tower was little more than a hollow shell with a wooden stairway rising up through a creaking scaffolding. The architect had evidently added this structure primarily for the purposes of symmetry. The single room in the entire tower was at the very top, a room floored with wooden beams roughly adzed square.
"I'm getting too old to be climbing stairs in full armor," Sparhawk puffed when they were about halfway up.
"You're out of condition, Sparhawk,"
Halad told his lord bluntly.
"You're spending too much time on your backside talking about politics."
"It's part of my job, Halad."
They reached the door at the top of the stairs.
"You'd better let me go in first," Sparhawk murmured, sliding his sword out of its scabbard.
Then he reached out and pushed the door open.
A shabby-looking man sat at a wooden table in the center of the room, his face lighted by a single candle. Sparhawk knew him. The years of hard drinking had not been kind to Krager. His hair had thinned even more in the 6 or so years since Sparhawk had last seen him, and the puffy pouches under his eyes were even more pronounced. The eyes themselves, nearsighted and watery, were discolored, and seemed to be overlaid with a kind of yellow stain. The hand in which he held his wine cup palsied, and a continual tick shuddered in his right cheek. Sparhawk moved without even stopping to think. He leveled his sword at Martell's threadbare former underling, and lunged. There was no feeling of resistance as the sword plunged into Krager's chest and emerged from his back. Krager flinched violently, and then he laughed in his rusty, drink-corroded voice.
"God, that's a startling experience," he said conversationally. "I could almost feel the blade running through me. Put your sword away, Sparhawk. You can't hurt me with it."
Sparhawk pulled the sword out of Krager's substantial-appearing body and swept it back and forth through the man's head.
"Please don't do that, Sparhawk," Krager said, closing his eyes. "It's really very unnerving, you know." "My compliments to your magician, Krager," Sparhawk said flatly. "That's really a very convincing illusion. You look so real that I can almost smell you." "I see that we're going to be civilized about this," Krager said, taking a drink of his wine. "Good. You're growing up, Sparhawk. 10 years ago, you'd have chopped the room into kindling before you'd have finally been willing to listen to reason."
"Magic?"
Hollad asked Sparhawk. Sparhawk nodded. "And fairly sophisticated, too. Actually, Krager's sitting in a room a mile or more away from here. Someone's projecting his image into this tower. We can see him and hear him, but we can't touch him."
"Pity,"
Hollad murmured, fingering the hilt of his heavy dagger.
"You've really been very clever this time, Sparhawk," Krager said. "Age seems to be improving you, like a good wine." "You're the expert on that, Krager." "Petty, Sparhawk. Very petty." Krager smirked. "Before you engage in an orgy of self-congratulation, though, you ought to know that this was just another of those tests a friend of mine mentioned to you a while back. I told my associates all about you, but they wanted to see for themselves. We arranged a few entertainments for you so that you could demonstrate your prowess and your limitations. The catapults definitely confused the seer guy, and your mounted tactics against the trolls were almost brilliant. You also did remarkably well in an urban setting here in Matherion. You really surprised me on that score, Sparhawk. You caught on to our sign and countersign much faster than I'd thought you would, and you intercepted the message about the warehouse in a remarkably short period of time. That Dakite merchant only had to walk through town 3 times before your spy stole the note from him. I'd have expected you to fail miserably when faced with a conspiracy instead of an army in the field. My congratulations." "You've been drinking for too many years, Krager. Your memory's starting to slip. You're forgetting what happened in Kyrellos during the election. As I recall, we countered just about every one of the schemes Martell and Anias cooked up there as well."
"That wasn't really a very great accomplishment, Sparhawk. Martell and Anias weren't really very challenging opponents. I tried to tell them that their plots weren't sophisticated enough, but they wouldn't listen. Martell was too busy thinking about the treasure rooms under the basilica, and Anias was so blinded by the arch-prelate's mitre that he couldn't see anything else. You really missed your chance there, Sparhawk. I've always been your most serious opponent. You had me right in your hands, and you let me go just for the sake of a few crumbs of information and some exaggerated testimony before the hierocracy. Very poor thinking there, old boy."
"This evening's festivities weren't really designed to succeed then, I gather?" Of course not, Sparhawk. If we'd really wanted to take Masterion, we'd have brought in whole armies.
I'm sure there's a point to all this, Sparhawk said to the illusion. Do you suppose we could step right along? I've had a tiring day.
The tests have all been designed to oblige you to commit your resources, Sparhawk. We needed to know what kinds of responses you had at your command.
You haven't seen them all yet, Krager. Not by half.
Khalad, isn't it? Krager said to Sparhawk's squire. Tell your master that he should practice a bit more before he tries lying. He's really not very convincing. Oh, convey my regards to your mother. She and I always got on well.
I sort of doubt that, Khalad replied.
Be realistic, Sparhawk, Krager went on. Your wife and daughter are here. Do you really expect me to believe that you'd hold anything back if you thought they were in danger?
We used what was necessary, Krager. You don't have to send out a whole regiment to step on a bug.
You're so much like Martell was, Sparhawk, Krager observed. You two could almost have been brothers. I used to despair of ever nursing him through his adolescence. He was a hopeless innocent when he started out, you know. About all he had was a towering resentment, directed primarily at you and Vanyan, and at Sephrenia, of course, although to a lesser degree. I had to raise him from virtual infancy. God, the hours I spent patiently grinding away all those knightly virtues.
Reminisce on your own time, Krager. Get to the point. Martell's history now. This is a new situation, and he's not around anymore.
Just renewing our acquaintance, Sparhawk. You know, the good old days and all that. I've found a new employer, obviously.
I gathered as much.
When I was working for Martell, I had very little direct contact with Otha, and almost none with Azash himself. That situation might have had an entirely different outcome if I'd had direct access to the Zemach god. Martell was obsessed with revenge, and Otha was too sunk in his own debauchery for either of them to think clearly. They were giving Azash very poor advice as a result of their own limitations. I could have given him a much more realistic assessment of the situation.
Provided you were ever sober enough to talk.
That's beneath you, Sparhawk. Oh, I'll admit that I take a drink now and then, but never so much that I lose sight of the main goals. Actually, it turned out better for me in the long run. If I'd been the one advising Azash, he'd have beaten you. Then I'd have been inextricably involved with him, and I'd have been destroyed when he confronted Sirgon. That's my new employer's name, by the way. You've heard of him, I suppose?
A few times.
Sparhawk forced himself to sound casual. Good. That saves us a lot of time. Pay attention now, Sparhawk. We are getting to the significant part of this little chat. Sirgon wants you to go home. Your presence here on the Daresian continent is an inconvenience. Nothing more, really. Just an inconvenience. If you had Bellium in your pocket, we might take you seriously. But you don't. And so we don't. You're all alone here, my old friend. You don't have the Bellium, and you don't have the Church Knights. You've only got the remnants of Aelana's honor guard, and 100 of those mounted apes from Pelosia. You're hardly worth even noticing. If you go home, Sirgon will give you his pledge not to move against the Eosian continent for 100 years. You'll be long dead by then, and so will everybody you care about. It's not really a bad offer, you know. You get yourself 100 years of peace just by getting on a ship and going back to Simura.
And if I don't?
We'll kill you. After we've killed your wife and your daughter and everybody else in the whole world you care about. There's another possibility, of course. You could join us. Sirgon could see to it that you lived longer than even Otha did. He specifically told me to make you that offer. thank him for me, if you ever see him again. You're declining, I gather? Obviously. I haven't seen nearly as much of Dereja as I want to see, so I think I'll stay for a while. And I'm sure I wouldn't care for the company of you and Sirgon's other hirelings. I told Sirgon you'd take that position, but he insisted that I make the offer. If he's so all-powerful, why is he trying to bribe me? Out of respect, Sparhawk. Can you believe that? He respects you because you're Annika. The whole concept baffles him, and he's intrigued by it. I honestly believe he'd like to get to know you. You know how childish gods can be at times. Speaking of gods, what's behind this alliance he's made with the troll gods? Then Sparhawk thought of something. Never mind, Krager. I've just worked it out for myself. A god's power is dependent on the number of worshippers he has. The Sirgai are extinct. So Sirgon's no more than a squeaky little voice making hollow pronouncements in a ruin somewhere in central Seneska. All noise and no substance. Someone's been telling you fairy tales, Sparhawk. The Sirgai are far from extinct, as you'll find out to your sorrow if you stay in Tamale. Sirgon made the alliance with the troll gods in order to bring the trolls to Dereja. Your Etons are very impressive, but they're no match for trolls. Sirgon's very sentimental about his chosen people. He'd rather not lose them needlessly in skirmishes with a race of freaks. So he made an arrangement with the troll gods. The trolls will get the pleasure of killing and eating the Etons. Krager drained the rest of his wine. This is starting to bore me, Sparhawk. And my cup's gone empty. I told Sirgon I'd present you with his offer. He's giving you the chance to live out the rest of your life in peace. I'd advise you to take it. He won't make the offer again. Really, old boy, why should you care what happens to the Tamils? They're nothing but yellow monkeys, after all. Church policy, Krager. Our Holy Mother takes the long view. Tell Sirgon to take his offer and stick it up his nose. I'm staying. It's your funeral, Sparhawk. Krager laughed. I might even send flowers. I've had all the entertainment of knowing a pair of anachronisms. You and Martell. I'll drink to your memories from time to time, if I remember you at all. And then the illusion of the shabby scoundrel vanished.
So that's Krager,
Khalad said in a chill tone.
I'm glad I got the chance to meet him.
What exactly have you got in mind, Khalad?
I thought I might kill him just a little bit. Fair's fair, Sparhawk. You got Martell, Talon got Adis, so Krager's mine.
Sounds fair to me, Sparhawk agreed. Was he drunk? Kultan asked. Krager's always a little drunk, Sparhawk replied. He wasn't so far gone that he got careless, though.
He looked around.
Would everybody like to say, I told you so, right here and now? He asked them. Let's have it out of the way right at the start, so I don't have it hanging over my head. Yes, it probably would have been more convenient if I'd killed him the last time I saw him. But if we hadn't had his testimony to the hierocracy at the time of the election, Dolmont probably wouldn't be the archprelate right now.
I might be able to learn to live with that, Elana murmured.
Be nice, Amban told her.
Only joking, Your Grace. Are you sure you repeated what he said verbatim? Sophronia asked Sparhawk.
It was very close, little mother,
Khalad assured her. She frowned.
It was contrived. I'm sure you all realize that. Krager didn't really tell us anything we didn't already know, or couldn't have guessed.
The name Sirgon hadn't come up before, Sophronia. Vanyan disagreed.
And it may very well never come up again, she replied. I'd need a lot more than Krager's unsubstantiated word before I'll believe that Sirgon's involved.
Well, somebody's involved, Tinian noted. Somebody had to be impressive enough to get the attention of the troll gods, and Krager doesn't quite fit that description.
Not to mention the fact that Krager can't even pronounce magic, much less use it, Kalton added. Could just any Styrek have cast that spell, little mother? Sephrenia shook her head.
It's very difficult, she conceded. If it hadn't been done exactly right, Sparhawk's sword would have gone right through the real Krager. Sparhawk would have started the thrust in that room up in the tower, and it would have finished up in a room a mile away, sliding through Krager's heart.
All right, then, Imban said, pacing up and down the room with his pudgy hands clasped behind his back. Now we know that this so-called uprising tonight wasn't intended seriously. Sparhawk shook his head.
No, Your Grace, we don't know that for certain. Regardless of what he says, Krager learned much of his style from Martell, and trying to shrug a failure off by pretending that the scheme wasn't really serious in the first place is exactly the sort of thing Martell would have done.
You knew him better than I did, Amban grimaced. Can we really be sure that Krager and the others are working for a god? Sirgon, or maybe some other one? Not really, Amban, Sephrenia replied. The troll gods are involved, and they could be doing the things we've encountered that are beyond the capability of a human magician. There's a sorcerer out there, certainly, but we can't be certain that there's a god, other than the troll gods, involved as well.
But it could be a god, couldn't it? Amban pressed.
Anything's possible, Your Grace.
She shrugged.
That's what I needed to know, the fat little churchman said. It rather looks as if I'm going to have to make a flying trip back to Kyrellos.
That went by me a little fast, Your Grace, Kalton confessed.
We're going to need the church knights, Kalton, Amban said. All of them. They're committed to Rendor, Your Grace, Bevier reminded him. Rendor can wait.
The Archprelate may feel differently about that, Amban, Vanyan told him. Reconciliation with the Rendors has been one of our Holy Mother's goals for over half a millennium now.
She's patient. She'll wait. She's going to have to wait. This is a crisis, Vanyan.
I'll go with you, Your Grace, Tinian said. I won't be of much use here in Tamale until my shoulder heals anyway, and I'll be able to clarify the military situation to Sarathi much better than you will. Dolmont's had Pandion training, so he'll understand military terminology. Right now, we're standing out in the open with our britches down, begging Your Majesty's pardon for the crudity of that expression. He apologized to Aelana.
It's an interesting metaphor, Sir Tinian, she smiled, and it conjures up an absolutely enthralling image.
I'll agree with the Patriarch of Usera, Tinian went on. We definitely have to have the church knights here in Tamale. If we don't get them here in a hurry, this whole situation's going to crumble right in our hands.
I'll send word to Takumi, Kring volunteered. He'll send us several thousand mounted Poloi. We don't wear armor or use magic, but we know how to fight.
Will you be able to hold out here until the church knights arrive, Vanyan?
Amban asked. Talk to Sparhawk, Amban. He's in charge.
I wish you wouldn't keep doing that, Vanyan, Sparhawk objected.
He thought for a moment. Eitan and Gessa, he said then. How hard was it to persuade your warriors that it's not really unnatural to fight on horseback? Can we persuade any more of them?
When I tell them that this Krager drunkard called them a race of freaks, they'll listen to me, Sparhawk Knight.
Good. Krager may have helped us more than he thought, then. Are you convinced that it's best to attack trolls with war horses and lances, my friend?
It was most effective, Sparhawk Knight. We haven't encountered the troll beasts before. They're bigger than we are. That may be difficult for my people to accept, but once they do, they'll be willing to try horses, if you can find enough of those big ones.
Did Krager happen to make any references to the fact that we've been using thieves and beggars as our eyes and ears? Stragan asked.
Not in so many words, my lord,
Khalad replied. That puts an unknown into our equation, then, Stragan mused. Please don't do that, Stragan, Kalton pleaded. I absolutely hate mathematics.
Sorry. We don't know for certain whether Krager's aware that we've been using the criminals of Mathurian as spies. If he is aware of it, he could use it to feed us false information. That spell they used sort of hints that they know Stragan, Kalador noted. That explains how it was that we saw the leaders of the conspiracy go into a house and never come out. They used illusions. They wouldn't have done that if they hadn't known we were watching. Stragan stuck out his hand and wobbled it from side to side a bit dubiously.
It's not set in stone yet, Kalador, he said. He may not know just exactly how well organized we are.
Bevier's expression was profoundly disgusted. We've been had, my friends, he said. This was all an elaborate ruse. Armies from the past, resurrected heroes, vampires and ghouls, all of it. It was a trick with no other purpose than to get us to come here without the entire body of the Church Knights at our back.
Then why have they turned around and told us to go home, Sir Bevier? Talon asked him.
Maybe they found out that we were a little more effective than they thought we'd be, Ulof rumbled. I don't think they really expected us to break up that Sirgai assault, or exterminate 100 trolls, or break the back of this coup attempt the way we did. It's altogether possible that we surprised them, and even upset them more than a little. Krager's visit could have been sheer bravado, you know. We might not want to get overconfident, but I don't think we should get underconfident either. We're professionals, after all, and we've won every encounter so far. Let's not give up the game and run away just because of a few windy threats by a known drunkard.
Well said, Tinian murmured.
We don't have any choice, Afriel, Sparhawk told his daughter later, when they were alone with Sephrenia and Vanyan in a small room several floors above the royal apartment. It's going to take Emban and Tinian at least 3 months to get back to Kyrellos, and then 9 months for the Church Knights to come overland to Deresia. Even then, they'll still be present only in the Western Kingdoms.
Why can't they come by boat?
The princess sounded a bit sulky, and she was holding Rollo tightly to her chest.
There are 100,000 Church Knights, Afriel, Vanyan reminded her. 25,000 in each of the four orders. I don't think there are enough ships in the world to transport that many men and horses. We can bring in a few thousand by ship, but the bulk of them will have to come overland. We won't be able to count on even that few thousand for at least 6 months, the time it's going to take Emban and Tinian to reach Kyrellos and then come back by ship with the knights and their horses. Until they arrive, we're all alone here. With your britches down, she added.
Watch your tongue, young lady, Sparhawk scolded her. She shrugged that off.
My instincts all tell me that it's a very bad idea, she told them. I went to a lot of trouble to find a safe place for Bellion, and the first time there's a little rain shower, you all want to run to retrieve it. Are you sure you're not exaggerating the danger? Ulof might have been right, you know. Everything Krager said to you could have been sheer bluster. I still think you can handle it without Bellion.
I disagree, Sephrenia told her. I know Aline's better than you do, Afriel. It's not in their nature to exaggerate dangers. Quite the reverse, actually.
The whole point here is that your mother may be in danger, Sparhawk told his daughter. Until Tinian and Emban bring the Church Knights to Tamale, we are seriously overmatched. Even as stupid as they are, it was only the Bellium that gave us any advantage over the troll gods last time. You couldn't even deal with them, as I recall.
That's a hateful thing to say, Sparhawk, she flared.
I'm just trying to get you to look at this realistically, Afriel. Without the Bellium, we are all in serious danger here. And I'm not just talking about your mother and all our friends. If Krager was telling the truth, and we are matched up against Sirgon, he's at least as dangerous as Azash was.
Are you sure all of these flimsy excuses aren't coming into your head because you want to get your hands on Bellium again, Sparhawk? She asked him. Nobody's really immune to its seduction, you know. There's a great deal of satisfaction to be had in wielding unlimited power.
You know me better than that, Afriel, he said reproachfully. I don't go out of my way looking for power.
If it is, Sirgon, his first step would be to exterminate the Styrix, you know, Sephrenia reminded the little goddess. He hates us for what we did to his Sirgai.
Why are you all joining forces to bully me? Afriel demanded.
Because you're being stubborn, Sparhawk replied.
throwing Belium into the sea was a very good idea when we did it. But the situation's changed now. I know that it's not in your nature to admit that you made a mistake. But you did, you know.
Bite your tongue. We have a new situation here, Afriel, Sophronia said patiently. You've told me again and again that you can't fully see the future, so you couldn't really have foreseen all of what's happening here in Tamale. You didn't really make a mistake, baby sister, but you have to be flexible. You can't let the world fly all to pieces just because you want to maintain a reputation for infallibility.
Oh, all right, Afriel gave in, flinging herself into a chair and starting to suck her thumb as she glared at them.
Don't do that, Sparhawk and Sophronia told her in unison.
She ignored them. I want all three of you to know that I'm really very put out with you for this. You've been very impolite and very inconsiderate of my feelings. I'm ashamed of you. Go ahead. I don't care. Go ahead and get the Belium if you think you absolutely have to have it.
Afriel, Sparhawk said mildly. We don't know where it is, remember?
That's not my fault, she replied in a sulky little voice.
Yes, actually it is. You were very careful to make sure that we didn't know where we were when we threw it into the sea.
That's a spiteful thing to say, Father.
A horrible thought suddenly occurred to Sparhawk.
You do know where it is, don't you? He asked her anxiously.
Oh, Sparhawk, don't be silly. Of course I know where it is. You didn't think I'd let you put it someplace where I couldn't find it, did you?
Here ends Domes of Fire, Book 1 of the Tamale. Book 2, The Shining Ones, follows the quest to reclaim Belium from the deep and to battle strange evil in a far distant land. End of Domes of Fire, The Tamale, Book 1, by David Eddings. Narrated by Eric Sandvold in the studios of Talking Book Publishers, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, August 1993. For special distribution, as authorized by Act of Congress, under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Ballantine Books, a division of Random House, Incorporated, New York, New York, 10022. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.